John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting today from the studios of KERA in Dallas, Texas. Thanks so much for listening. We're going to be talking about the challenge of government, writ large and small. I headed down to Texas this weekend to attend the U.S. Conference of Mayors. We'll talk about the tangible excitement of city politics and city officials with some of the nation's most prominent mayors in just a few minutes. Plus, we'll kick off a week-long look into police departments around the U.S., beginning today with how hiring affects the style of policing in the state of New Jersey. But we begin this hour on the questions of governance on the tense border between Iraq and Syria, which has become a stronghold for the Sunni militant group known as the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. For more than 3 years, President Bashar al-Assad has struggled to maintain power over Syria as an Arab Spring protest morphed into a civil war, a divide between the government and increasingly militant rebels. Last September, President Obama decided against direct involvement in Syria, opting instead to a United Nations-sponsored initiative to rid Assad of his chemical weapons. Now, the rebels America declined to support have become radical, and the border between Syria and Iraq becomes porous. Armed militants take control of northern Iraq. The Syrian civil war we've watched from afar threatens to destabilize much of the Middle East. Joining us now is Lara Satrakian, co-founder and executive editor of Syria Deeply. Lara, welcome.
Good to be with you.
How important is this tactical advantage that the ISIS forces seem to have using Syria as a base of operations, as a population that it can both exploit and, hide behind? There are all sorts of military advantages here.
You know, I'm not normally one for hyperbole, but it is impossible to state just how devastatingly consequential this set of factors is for Syria, Iraq, the Middle East, global security. First, you had ISIS really emerging in Syria April of last year, taking key areas like the city of Raqqa in Syria, basically becoming their de facto capital. So already creating an operating base for ISIS. That gives them the strength, the momentum, the confidence, the practice, the tactical assets to expand what had already been very active and violent scope of attacks in Western Iraq. Now, so essentially taking ground in Syria that gave them an advantage in Iraq, and now taking broad swaths of ground in Iraq, which gives them an advantage in Syria. We're seeing videos today of the equipment, the U.S.-made equipment, tanks, heavy weapons, that had been spotted moving across the border from Iraq into Syria, now being used in battle by ISIS against more moderate rebel groups in Syria. So really just trying to stitch together for you that these have been one conflict for some time. This has been one theater of war for ISIS for some time. That's how they see it, and that's how we are now forced to treat it out of Washington.
And, as far as anticipating from the perspective of a U.S. general or Air Force general trying to imagine what sorts of airstrikes might be effective, ISIS quite easily can store its U.S.-built assets or, Russian-built military assets inside Syria, maintain them there, keep weapons stashes there, and U.S. drones and, overflight planes would have to penetrate Syrian airspace to get at those arms and weapons caches, and that's a very dangerous operation. So those are protected assets right now with this kind of configuration.
Absolutely. ISIS is a tumor that has effectively metastasized, and it's expanding like a black blob over Western Iraq and Eastern Syria. To have the city of Mosul means that they have a lot of the infrastructure of the state in the sense that they have banks, they have weapons caches, they have ammunitions, they took one weapon silo that's been compared to the Walmart of ammunition, much of it given to the Iraqi military from the United States. So they have tremendous assets. This is a group that now has terrain. It now has a de facto country. Paul Salem at the Middle East Institute is now referring to this ISIS-held terrain as Syriac, this space between the two countries that is now becoming the ISIS vision for an Islamic caliphate. Western officials, frankly, do not expect Iraqi authorities or the Iraqi army to retake the ground they've lost to ISIS. In other words, by all accounts, by all analysis, this is now a semi-permanent fixture. And from all of the sort of policy approaches we've heard out of President Barack Obama and other officials in Washington, none of them are especially promising.
So now I'm a little bit frustrated. So if the pattern persists and Europe is not the Middle East, then we shouldn't compare them. But are we now going to see ISIS calling for a referendum in the territory of Mosul to try to annex some form of territory around Mosul and central and western Iraq? And just as the Ukrainians talk as though Crimea is gone, are the Iraqis going to begin to speak of this part of Iraq as basically gone somewhere?
We're already seeing signs of that. We're already seeing this sense of clear separation, delineation between the Sunni and Shiite space in Iraq. And unlike in the Ukraine and Crimea, ISIS is perfectly happy to crown itself king without a referendum. This is something they feel is religiously legitimate. And their perspective, their worldview within ISIS of this being a state, a caliphate, an Islamic arena that they can continue to expand is actually attractive to a certain set of young, disaffected Muslim men that they're looking to attract. So it is exasperating because we've watched this unfold in slow motion, in particular over the past 14 months. And what seemed inevitable has now come to pass. And everything that is happening in Iraq makes everything that's happening in Syria considerably worse. The picture is that bleak across these two countries. And not coming up with the solution is essentially going to entrench the situation we've seen over the past 10 days.
The rhetoric from Christiane Amanpour, as she described ISIS's mission, was that they were impatient with al-Qaeda in that al-Qaeda is not as militant and radical as al-Qaeda. Now, does that exclude the possibility of Middle Eastern players or even the U.S. having to speak with ISIS on some level to discuss some sort of power-sharing situation in this situation? Does ISIS have a position on Israel, for instance? Does ISIS have a position on Sharia law that would be deal breakers? We certainly know that the U.S. was prepared to talk to the Taliban at some point regarding Afghanistan. That seems to be a place we're going to be very, very quickly on this road.
I wouldn't rule out the fact that ISIS somehow, sometime, would have to be dealt into a more stable equilibrium. But these are not the types of people that the U.S. can even necessarily have a rational conversation with. I think the U.S. hope is that within the realm of all these people who now live under ISIS rule, that there will be more reasonable, more moderate Sunnis who want something different and who do not want to see ISIS rule become the norm. The hope is that somehow you can detach ISIS from the terrain that it's now seized. ISIS has now essentially scored the biggest jihadi victory in modern history, and it's basically going to ride that as far as it can to suck the wind out of al-Qaeda's sails.
Lara Satrakian, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Lara Satrakian is co-founder and executive editor of Syria Deeply. Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in Iraq this morning to meet with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki as ISIS continues to take over key cities along the Syria-Iraq border. Over the weekend, the extremist group also finally captured Iraq's largest oil refinery, a major blow to the Iraqi government and Baghdad's energy security, and a sudden source of cash for ISIS. Oil is just one of the ISIS business strategies, which includes a diverse portfolio of looting banks, trafficking in weapons, counterfeiting currency, all more than capable of funding its operations. What's behind the vast cash flow of ISIS? For answers, we turn to Aaron Zellin, the Richard Borrow Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Aaron, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So they've got quite a bankroll, ISIS does at this point. Can you enumerate it for us?
Yeah, ISIS is a very unique Sunni jihadi organization in that they don't really get money from private donors in the Gulf like we've seen in the past with Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula or others. They more or less have become self-sufficient. Part of this is because they're paranoid about being reliant on anybody else. So a lot of their money comes from black market, whether it's running business rackets, whether it's kidnapped for ransom, whether it's counterfeit currency. They're also illegally selling refined oil in areas that they've taken over. They've also gotten artifacts inside of Syria, thousands of years old, that they've been trafficking, as well as a number of other things, including the recent robbing of the central bank in Mosul. This has helped pad their coffers, and now they're probably the richest Sunni jihadi group we've ever seen.
And how well maintained is this Iraqi capability? I mean, and can they keep it maintained and keep the oil flowing? And I guess people will buy oil no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen in the Syrian case that ISIS has been able to use the oil in the territory that they've taken over the past 8 months or so and still been able to sell it on the black market. So even though people don't necessarily like ISIS, they will likely find a buyer.
And, that's been true throughout this crisis. I mean, it's been one of the problems with sanctions. Once you get once removed from ISIS or Iran or Iraq or one of the sanctions targeted companies, it becomes a commodity and is completely fungible.
Yeah. And the thing is that they're putting all of the money that they're gaining from oil or other activities that they've been conducting back into their military operations, whether it's in Iraq or Syria. They even now have their eyes set on Saudi Arabia and Jordan based off of some recent propaganda, as well as into the social services and sort of proto-governments that they've been trying to operate in areas that they've taken over.
Can they induce Jordan to actually give them agricultural supplies? And can they be an inducement to Jordan to actually, join forces with ISIS in some level? Jordan is very isolated out there.
No, Jordan will not give in to ISIS. They've been at war with ISIS more or less going back a decade or so when the group was originally in charge by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who himself is a Jordanian. So the Jordanians will never give in to ISIS. And there are rumors that ISIS is trying to take a border crossing with Jordan. And if that's the case, we'll likely see, for the first time, Jordan being dragged into this broader regional conflict now, since their soldiers will likely start fighting them too.
And any issue with Iran? Does Iran contain them on the northern side?
They're getting closer to the Iranian border. It's believed that in one of the parts they're only about 10 kilometers away. And, one of the biggest aspects for ISIS is their war with the Shia. So if they have an opportunity to cross border attacks, I would not be surprised if we would see that as well.
He's the Richard Borrow Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Aaron Zellin, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Later this hour, writer and director Paul Haggis on his new film Third Person, a bizarre story that explores the outside influences that threaten the stability of every relationship. From an abandoned spouse to an innocent child, a relationship always involves more than the two in love.
There's always a person, someone in a relationship who's influencing it, but often you don't know who that person is. You think it's, your mother-in-law or something like that, and it's not. It's something from your past. It's someone you're not even aware of who's influencing, the outcome of that relationship.
That's coming up here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So as we've been discovering down here in Dallas, Texas, mayors at the U.S. Conference of Mayors tend to be pretty proud of their work on the front lines of delivering government services. At the National Council on Mayors meeting, I got a lot of enthusiasm with working on the front lines of civic problems. People are very interested in the engagement of their citizens. We'll hear in a moment of a conversation I had with the mayor of Philadelphia, Michael Nutter, a city showing signs of making real progress and inroads into some of the toughest problems in that city. First, a few voices from all over the country, all of them mayors, applying their own local issues and solutions to problems that play out in more or less every American city. And we start with the mayors of Houston and Dallas, Anise Parker and Mike Rawlings.
We're creating generations of young people who do not know the promise of America, don't know that they can't reach the promise of America, and have no concept of what a future could be.
Income disparity is costing us millions and millions and millions of dollars. And we can take money and spend it the right way, or we can waste the money. That is a conversation that everybody in Texas knows how to have because we do like money.
Two mayors from very different cities talking about the disillusionment of young people in their cities, in the case of Anise Parker from Houston, or the income disparity problem, which is what Mike Rawlings wanted to talk about. Rawlings and Parker of Dallas and Houston, respectively, both Democrats in an otherwise very Republican state, and their battle plays out in both at the state and federal level. The president of this year's Mayor's Conference is a former NBA point guard, Kevin Johnson, who loves calling himself President Johnson in the state of Texas, where there once was a President Johnson a few years back. He's now top dog at City Hall in Sacramento. Both Mayor Johnson and Nutter went out of their way to highlight one of America's most troubling divides.
The college population for black males, 5%. 5%. Prison population for black males, a third. 35%. That's just unacceptable. The people that are incarcerated over and over again, they felt they were limited with their opportunities. There's no one who wants to sit on the sidelines and not work. I mean, the diversity that you see up here is real. We're not just talking. We're not waiting for somebody else to solve the problems. We don't have that luxury.
Black males represent 6% of the population of the United States of America. 6%. But they are 43% of the homicide victims all across the United States of America. This is a national problem. It is a crisis in the making.
That's the most downbeat statistic that Mayor Nutter likes to convey when he's talking to journalists and other citizens. But he's always got a smile on his face. Nutter says there are so many symbolic postponements or can-kicking-down-the-road strategy in federal politics and state politics. You can't do that on the local level. So what you can and what you're going to do is all that it's about in city politics.
We can't pass a continuing resolution on whether we're going to pick up the trash or not, or have police officers on the street, or water in swimming pools. I mean, it's every day. It's all day, every day, and it's 50 different things all going on at the same time. And so mayors are just people of action. I mean, that's what happens at the local level. People expect, you know, that abandoned cars are going to get taken care of, that a building that's falling down is going to get taken down and something else put in its place. And so there's, you know, job training and workforce development and public safety issues, all of which we could be doing so much more, you know, if we had the resources and the support and the help by the federal government and our Congress. We can't wait. We're not going to wait. We're not standing around. We're putting plans forward and making things happen.
On early childhood education, in some ways this looks like the puzzle for the three-year-old, in the sense that there's a no-brainer need for child care. There's a no-brainer need for child support and caregiver support. There's a no-brainer need for early childhood education. Can putting those together suddenly put in place a system that gives parents help, gives daycare help, and melds seamlessly with the public school system?
If you were able to put all those factors together, one, you would absolutely transform what really happens in the lives of children early on. But also, again, as you mentioned, child care issues and transportation issues and housing issues, you'll change that entire family's circumstance. And so we know the things that need to be done. What's lacking is the resources and the coordination to make them happen at a much faster pace. And so the work that Mayor Mitch Landrieu and I and 56 other mayors are focused on the issue of violence in the African-American community, and that work is centered within what we call Cities United. Black, white, Latino, Asian, Democrats, Republicans, all across America, people want to be safe. If people don't feel safe in your city, then you can never truly be a great city. If our young people are not reading at grade level by third grade, that's a child who's more likely going to struggle through middle school, possibly drop out in high school. And then what are your life prospects in the 21st century? And so we know what works. We know that if we put our efforts together and if we have the resources, the United States of America will flourish.
Last 6 years, federal government been a disappointment to the people of Philadelphia?
you know, President Obama and his administration, they've been fantastic for the city of Philadelphia. We've won any number of different grants. We're a Promise Zone city, one of the first five. I think the issue here is missed opportunities, missed potential, and the gridlock and the Congress constantly fighting with the president. And as I said in my earlier remarks, I mean, he is, you know, taking the attitude and the stance that he will do the things that he can do as a chief executive officer, and we're already starting to see some of the fruits of that work. So, you know, look, I can't do anything about the past. I can do something about today and tomorrow and the days and weeks and months and years ahead, and that's where my focus is, and I'm trying to make progress.
Michael Nutter is the mayor of Philadelphia. I spoke with him this weekend at the U.S. Conference of Mayors taking place in Dallas. Later this hour, a look at the cost of infighting at the New Jersey Police Department. It's part of our week-long look at the state of law enforcement across the country. How do you rate your local police department? Share your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. As a police officer, do you know anything about why they were hired and how they got into the position they're in to potentially take your freedom away? What's uppermost in their mind as they consider your case? Is loyalty to their superiors a bigger deal than the rule of law they're supposed to be enforcing?
So to fit in with those political appointments, you have to sort of toe the line. And if you're going to toe the line, you'll get appointed to one of those positions. And that's why you don't see things like an open hiring process, the knowledge, skills, and abilities for this particular job reduced to writing, and then we recruit from the strongest pool possible. We don't do that. We just hire from within. We hire our friends, and we hire those that we're comfortable with because we know that they'll toe the line.
That's retired police captain John Shane talking about the situation in the state of New Jersey. He used to work as a police captain in Newark and is now a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. All this week, we're exploring the state of law enforcement across the U.S. And a new investigation by reporter and WNYC contributor Sally Herships has found that internal department fighting across New Jersey is costing that state's taxpayers millions of dollars. $29 million to be exact. That's the amount New Jersey residents paid between 2009 and 2012 to foot the bill for legal fees and settlements arising from employment battles and HR conflicts between officers, departments, and towns. And the root cause for a lot of these problems and lawsuits has to do with the hiring practices taking place inside police departments, hiring that is often based simply on loyalty.
The way that police officers are hired and promoted has a lot to do with the problems that come up later. So in New Jersey and in a lot of places around the country, police chiefs are appointed by politicians. So if you have a good police chief, you won't end up with any problems. But if you have someone who's a little bit more slippery, that chief is going to be inclined to stay loyal to the politician who appointed them. And that loyalty is going to trickle right down the forces. So the chief is going to bring in a captain who's going to be loyal to him. The captain's going to bring in a lieutenant. The lieutenant's going to bring in a major. The major a sergeant, and so on. And so that loyalty is going to, you know, just move up and down the ranks. And instead of fostering loyalty to your profession, you end up with people who are loyal to an organization.
Is that bad?
If you want good policing, it could be really problematic. If you think of a traditional profession like law or medicine, a lawyer can just go take a bar exam and move from place to place. But because of the way the hiring within the police department works, where you have all of this loyalty, you can't move. If you move jobs at, you know, the intermediate or lower ranks, you have to start all over and work your way up.
Give me a general idea of how the way in which people are hired makes them choose between a loyalty that would contribute to law enforcement and something that might be a little ancillary.
Sure. I think John Shane talks about how you're told how you're going to do your job. So if you're in an intermediate rank, you are going to be told, you know, who gets a summons and who doesn't. and which streets to enforce speeding rules on and which streets not to.
Well, you're told how you're going to do your job. You're going to be told who gets a summons and who doesn't. And you're going to be told where to carry out your work and where not to carry out your work. So if we have speeding problems on this street, but on this street you have several council members who might be speeding, you're not going to set up an enforcement operation on that street. You're going to go to another street where no one's likely to complain. So it doesn't really, it's not in the interest necessarily sometimes of public safety, but, you know, politically how the winds blow, that's how enforcement is going to be carried out.
So obviously you can end up with some really problematic policing, and problematic policing can in turn lead to lawsuits. One of the really surprising things that John Shane told me is that when you think about the profession of policing, you think of it as a really stressful job, right? There are car chases, chasing bad guys, guns, potential danger to your health and safety. And we often assume that that is the most stressful part of the job. But actually, the organizational stress, the being told how to do your job, the administrative squabbles and the little trivial fighting, John Shane says, is more stressful than all of those other problems. And that creates, all of that stress creates more problems with policing and can lead to these millions of dollars in lawsuits.
And the idea of autocratic policing, depending upon how a rule book is used, can bear directly on the morale within the department. And here's John Shane talking specifically about that in Newark.
When in the hands of an autocratic manager, that rule book can become oppressive, and I can use it any way I see fit because there's a rule for everything. And I know that I'm going to be supported on the inside by my bosses. So I just then open up the page and find you without your hat, your shoes aren't shined, you're out of uniform some way, you're 3 feet out of your sector, and I'll charge you for it. And so goes the wheel of internal justice in the police department.
And so that code automatically enforces. And how would John Shane describe that situation as a professor versus how he described it as a captain in the police department?
I mean, what he says as a professor is that the stress that arises out of that, you know, administrative nitpicking can be incredibly damaging. And the practices that can come out of that, you can see officers, you know, doing anything from using excessive force when it's not required, stopping people when they shouldn't be stopped. And he says even the stress can even lead to alcohol, drugs, and even suicide. So, you know, it's pretty extreme.
And is there a fix here? Does John Shane have a fix? And is this widely understood throughout the New Jersey Police Department?
I mean, I think one fix that he mentions is hiring the best people for the job instead of hiring, you know, like he mentions, from within and looking to hire based on loyalty instead of ability.
And if this is the major issue, ability is clearly way down on the list.
Yeah, I think it's one of the issues. There are a lot of issues behind these lawsuits, but it's definitely one of the roots of the problem, the way police officers are hired and promoted. I mean, it's a slippery slope. He basically says, you know, in the problem departments, people are looking around and the sentiment is nobody really cares. Look at the people above me. What are they doing? If they're doing these things, no one's going to care that I'm doing them down here. And like he says, so goes the wheel of internal justice within the police department.
The opaque internal justice priorities within the police department in New Jersey causing all kinds of complications and actually contributing to executing justice on the street. Sally Herships is a reporter and contributor to Takeaway, co-producer WNYC. Sally, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Force with you. We're talking about the state of policing in America this week. How do you rate your local police force? What works and what doesn't? We'd love you to share your story. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So here's a question. Do these people love each other in Paul Haggis' new movie, Third Person, or do they just desperately need each other?
Is she having one of those days?
Don't talk about what you don't understand.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm being insensitive. I'm the one who just took a call from my spouse while I was with my lover.
That was stupid. I'm sorry.
It's the most overused word in your vocabulary.
Anna, I really need you to stop attacking me.
If you needed that, you wouldn't be with me.
It's actors Olivia Wilde and Liam Neeson keeping the audience in this film guessing about a dysfunctional couple, or are they a functional couple? Who is not functional? Who is and cannot be redeemed? Who can never be forgiven? It's all based on Haggis's notion of honesty in writing a very, very bizarre story. The movie also stars James Franco and Mila Kunis in New York and Adrian Brody and Moran Adias in Rome. The film is an absolute masterpiece of honesty and bravery that the audience will follow where Haggis, the director and the writer, wants to go.
I love to explore issues from the points of view of characters that I disagree with, people who bust myself for my own excuses and justifications, rationalizations, and that's as a matter of belief or lack thereof is my particular sin.
So you love to write in the middle of an argument with yourself in some way.
Exactly. That's what this was. And this took me 2.5 years to argue out as I was writing it.
In the Mercer Hotel?
There and other places, but often the Mercer.
That's an expensive place.
I wasn't staying in the Mercer. I lived down the street from the Mercer.
I see. Well, that's
they
good.
Were kind enough to let me write in the lobby. Yeah.
The third person, it reminds me of The Third Man, the grand Graham Greene novel and movie that, has a very different approach to this. But The Third Person really talks about how relationships are complete when you add a third person in some way. What were you trying to get to?
Yeah, I mean, I think the title certainly referred to that. The fact that there's always a person, someone in a relationship who's influencing it, but often you don't know who that person is. You think it's, your mother-in-law or something like that, and it's not. It's something from your past. It's someone you're not even aware of who's influencing the outcome of that relationship. But also, I loved the idea that this character, played by Liam Neeson, Michael, is a writer who is so distanced from his own feelings that he journals in the third person. His diary is in the third person, which is saying a lot about him. And then when his lover Olivia Wilde shows up, also a young author, they start talking about each other sometimes in playful ways. And sometimes very cruel ways in the third person.
These two actors in particular, Olivia Wilde and Liam Neeson, have a particular quality that I think you exploit amazingly on camera. Especially in the last few years, Liam Neeson, I think, has come into his own as really an actor who has an enormous amount of depth, whether he's doing a action adventure kind of thriller or something much more depth in terms of character. But he's got this ability to just make his face blank. And Olivia Wilde, almost the same way. They can go identityless. Adrian Brody, to a certain extent, which is what makes this cast
James
really
Franco
terrific.
In this.
Franco,
yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
No, I was blessed with a cast like that, and you want the audience to be able to sort of gaze into their eyes and look into their soul, and you want an actor who's brave enough to take that moment and allow you to do that. I think it was they really wanted to. Play characters that challenge them and dig in. And these are roles you've seen. Look at Olivia Wilde in this. You've never seen her like this.
No.
And Mila Kunis, the same. And then there's some wonderful new actors.
The quality of the whole world is in this movie. It's set in New York. It's set in Paris. It's set in Rome. You get to see all of those places. And this idea of a third person who has an influence on a relationship is almost astronomical in the sense there's this unseen planet that has an influence, but you've got to really use your telescope to discover who that is. And it's sort of the narrative of the whole story here. It's big, even though it's about small relationships.
Yeah, and it isn't a movie it isn't a movie for people who like to think literally. I loved those films from the 60s and 70s that challenged you in their form as well as their content and that asked more questions than they answered. It was the kind of film you had to and that's what I wanted to make, a film that you had to walk out on the sidewalk afterwards and argue about and go to the bar and hopefully think about the next day. Not that it was – this is not a Rubik's Cube of a puzzle. It's fairly simple, but hopefully some of those answers, some of those questions.
But raw and provocative. Resonate. So you're a fan of like Straw Dogs or Blow Up.
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. No, you've named two of my favorite films of all time.
Wow. You know, we don't make films like that these days.
No.
You don't see films like that these days.
Yeah, but I wanted to make one because I loved them so much.
What do you think people take away from this in terms of the arguments that they will have when this film is over?
I don't know. Hopefully they'll find themselves in one of these characters at least, and they won't necessarily be pleased about that. Or they'll find their lover or someone else, which is often easier. And it also, I really wanted to explore the nature of creativity, the role of a writer, and what that means, and what we do, and how selfish we are in that. How much, what we steal from, how we steal.
Say that almost confessionally. People could see your face. You're just like going, I have to confess.
Oh, yeah, it is. Because you steal from your life. You steal from the lives of those around you. When we're not nice about it, you just never have a relationship with a writer, no matter how pleasant they look on the outside. You say something cruel to them or say something loving to them, and often they're thinking, that's really, really nice. I can use that.
I'll invoice you if I've said anything decent today.
Thank you.
You really nailed the issue of racism in the movie Crash, I think, at least in terms of the audience's reaction to it. I mean, I think it was very provocative and people discussed and talked about, the issue. Do you think this will have the same kind of effect in the creative world?
I don't know. This is a... Crash was very personal. Those characters that I was talking about there were basically all me. I mean, I just put my fears in other characters. It's what I always do. My fears, my hopes, dreams, and I've done that here. But I don't know. I think this is a film people are really going to argue about, and hopefully it will touch them emotionally. They have a visceral reaction. And they'll leave satisfied if curious. Then I'll have done my job.
Well, that's a great aspiration. And I think highly likely that will be achieved. Certainly was in my case. Paul Haggis, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Paul Haggis is the director of Third Person, which is a great film. I highly recommend it. All week long, we are looking at the state of law enforcement across the U.S. Earlier, we heard about the high cost of infighting for police out in the state of New Jersey. How do you rate your local police force? What works? What isn't working? Give us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on that conversation. Listen back to anything on the program. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Tomorrow, we'll hear from EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International. Big thanks to our host helping us broadcast from the studios of KERA in Dallas. This is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.